Steve Fast with you this morning on WJBC. When Osama bin Laden was killed on May 2nd of 2011, it became the biggest story in the war on terror since perhaps the invasion of Iraq. But much of that story was left untold to the general public because of the clandestine operations involved in the hunt to find the world's most wanted man. This didn't stop books and newspaper articles to be filled somewhat with somewhat informed speculation as to the nature of the top secret operation to find and kill bin Laden. The latest such project is the Academy Award nominated film Zero Dark Thirty. But years from now, will we remember the events, even as details about them are declassified, or will we remember the film's version of the events? Timothy Melly, a professor at Miami University, has written about the realm where fictional accounts and covert activity meet. His new book, The Covert Sphere, Secrecy, Fiction, and the National Security State, examines how American fiction has been influenced by institutionalized deception, and perhaps vice versa. We welcome him to the show. Timothy Melly, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
There are a lot of things we accept about government-sponsored activities that are carried out by, as former Vice President Dick Cheney put it, those who work in the shadows. Mm-hmm. Does this force us to turn to fiction to fill in the gaps about what we think our own government does?
Yeah, it does, because one of the strange features of a policy that's clandestine is that the citizenry that has the responsibility to oversee the policy is prohibited from knowing about it. One of the results of that paradox is that fiction becomes one of the only sanctioned ways in which we can know certain things. That doesn't mean that nonfiction accounts of what's going on in U.S. clandestine policy are not surfacing. It also doesn't mean that leaks don't happen. They do. But fiction has a much larger role in helping us conceptualize and think through the policies that our government's engaged in. If you just think about the story that you opened with, the U.S. government is simultaneously involved in a couple of contradictory ways of approaching the raid on Osama bin Laden. On the one hand, there are widespread reports that the government assisted the filmmakers of Zero Dark Thirty, which is a fiction. At the same time, it's engaged in punishing the author Matt Bissonnette of No Easy Day, which is a nonfiction account of the same thing. It's also engaged in punishing a number of Navy SEALs who shared some details about their weaponry with a video game maker. So the state is, on the one hand, policing all of these secrets, and on the other hand, has this need to reveal some of them in order to gain support for its activities.
Well, and interestingly, the filmmakers of Zero Dark Thirty are also kind of in this dual messaging mode, because they say this is a film that is fictionalized, but at the same time, they go out of their way, especially Mark Bowl, the producer and screenwriter, to say, well, I did reporting. This is based on firsthand accounts of people involved with this. So they have it both ways. They can say, well, this is all real. But then they can also say, well, it's just a movie. There was no one tenacious CIA agent that followed this whole thing through from the beginning to the end.
That's exactly right, and I think that's one of the things that has drawn so much criticism. You know, there's a kind of implicit contract when you do journalism or memoir with the audience. You kind of openly state that you're not going to take certain kinds of liberties that are standard practice in fiction. That's what got James Frey, the author of A Million Little Pieces, in so much trouble. But to me, that itself, that criticism, is a symptom of an institutional problem that is haunting U.S. democracy, and that is really that we have no way of thinking about these things. Democratic Theory 101 says that you need a functioning public sphere in order to have a good democracy. The main quality of a good public sphere is that there's access to information, that people are able to contemplate, debate, and think rationally about what the state is doing so that they can actually exercise influence over it. And when things are kept from the public, that's simply not possible. So we enter a strange sort of deformed public sphere that I call the covert sphere when that happens. And the covert sphere is a place that is dominated by fiction and fantasy. We all think we know what our government is doing, but we don't really know in the way that we know about other kinds of policy. And that's because most of what we know, and if I were on TV, I'd put little scare quotes around the word know, most of what we think we know comes to us in the form of fiction.
Especially in the War on Terror era, we have public officials refer to fiction as a way to try to defend covert action. Many, many times when there would be critiques of rendition or enhanced interrogation techniques, you would hear public officials say, well, you know, look at the TV show 24, where they do this, and they need to get this information, and the hero tortures people to get the information to save other people.
It turns out that it's not just the public that is trapped in this strange covert sphere where we can only know things in the form of fiction. It turns out that our leaders, for really the past 60 years, have been caught in something like the same dilemma. So, you know, John F. Kennedy was really interested in James Bond and kept trying to find the U.S. James Bond. When Eisenhower heard reports coming back from Tehran when the CIA was overthrowing the Mossadegh government there, he described them as dime fiction. And this kind of quality in which our leaders think about policy through fiction goes right up through the War on Terror, where you have Diane Deaver of the Defense Intelligence Agency reporting that a high-level DIA workshop on interrogation focused a great deal on Jack Bauer, who, quote, gave people lots of ideas. Michael Chertoff, George W. Bush's chief of Homeland Security, said that 24 reflects real life and is what we do every day in government. Antonin Scalia spoke to an international panel of jurists and described his approach to the legal questions surrounding rendition by saying that Jack Bauer saved Los Angeles. Is any jury going to convict Jack Bauer? I don't think so. And the same thing is true for Bill Clinton, who arguably knows as much about the details of U.S. anti-terror policy. He went on Meet the Press in 2007 and talked about our policy explicitly in terms of 24.
One of the things that's interesting about that melding of fiction and covert activity is that it kind of goes back to the very roots of forming the CIA. In World War II, when Wild Bill Donovan was building the OSS, which would eventually morph into the CIA,
right,
he didn't go out and find a bunch of military guys. He went out and recruited writers and literature students, among others.
That is exactly right. One of the basic, and I think very much overlooked, qualities of intelligence work is that intelligence work consists in the production of fictions. Many of the plots that were engineered over the course of the Cold War are like bad spy novels. They have the same qualities, and they require the same attention to detail that a novelist brings to the creation of what are essentially false characters or fake documents. So there's that way in which intelligence work is fundamentally about the creation of fictions. And as you just pointed out, the early CIA was made up primarily of writers and people with training in literature. In fact, the most important counterintelligence agent of the Cold War, whose name was James Jesus Angleton, was known at the CIA as the poet because of his interest in poetry and his editorship of a poetry journal at Yale.
It touches on another Oscar-nominated movie, which is a fictionalized account of real events, but the CIA made up a story and made up a movie to try to actually conduct a clandestine operation. And that's what the movie Argo is about.
Exactly. And that's not unusual. Obviously, the operation in Argo is the creation of this fake movie in order to get to sort of heroically remove these hostages. But the beginning of the film refers back to an earlier similar kind of deception in which the CIA went into Iran in 1953 and engineered a fake coup against the first democratically elected leader in the region, Mohammad Mossadegh. And what they did was they hired actors, their own internal documents, which are now publicly available, refer to these guys as actors and terrorists. I mean, they went around and conducted these sort of fake demonstrations. They harassed clerics and said that they were doing so in the name of the Soviet Union. And basically they just engaged in a series of simulated political actions. The same thing was true in the Bay of Pigs, which was kind of a simulated coup. The same thing happened against the Arbenz regime in Guatemala in 1956. So that is not an unusual tactic.
We're talking with Timothy Melly. His new book is The Covert Sphere. Touching back upon the story of Argo, it's interesting that at different points in our history, the government, specifically the CIA, has sought out filmmakers and artists to engage in some of these paramilitary activities, including after 9/11, the Pentagon and the Department of Homeland Security started recruiting, again, just like was done back with the OSS, started recruiting artists to try to somehow involve in the fight on terror, whether it be through propaganda or creating false narratives. Talk a little bit about this.
That's been another feature of U.S. intelligence approaches for a very long time. One of the paradoxes of covert institutions is that they are, on the one hand, there's a need for secrecy, or at least a perceived need for secrecy. On the other hand, there is the need for publicity. The CIA, paradoxically, has a very large public relations division. And the reason for that is because covert institutions cost the United States at least $75 billion a year right now. So the public needs to believe that they're getting something for their money. So that's part of the reason that the CIA has always been, and not just the CIA, the intelligence community, which is really a much larger than just that one agency, it's always been engaged in a sort of public relations effort. But also the early CIA hired all kinds of writers, including many well-known writers, Peter Mathiasen, James Michener, William F. Buckley Jr., and many others, to do work on behalf of the agency. In fact, the CIA in the 1950s and 60s was probably the largest sponsor of Western art in the world. It spent millions and millions of dollars producing, just by itself, produced something like 1,000 novels, or supported the production of 1,000 novels. It engaged in things that seem strange right now, like it airdropped copies of T.S. Eliot's poems behind the Iron Curtain. The idea was that ideas and culture mattered so much that it had to influence people on the other side of the world by promoting Western ideas and Western culture. So it became a virtual ministry of culture.
Would these projects that they support always be directed towards other cultures and other nations, or would sometimes they be directed towards us?
Because ideas flow around the world, they're inevitably going to, you know, reach both populations. A more interesting way of thinking about that question that I've explored is the whole brainwashing scare that happened in the 1950s and 60s. During the Korean War, there was this terrifying sense that Americans had been brainwashed in China and had become totally controlled by some kind of magical process. This idea was first reported by a journalist in the Miami News named Edward Hunter, who then went on to write two very popular books about the subject. And then it eventually became repeated in famous movies like The Manchurian Candidate, and now we're seeing a kind of revival of that in the show Homeland. It turns out that Edward Hunter was a CIA officer working in the propaganda division. And so in a way, the idea of brainwashing was part of a scare campaign that was engineered to try to alarm Americans about the problem of thought control. I mean, after all, the idea of a Cold War is really, it's a war of ideas and a war of controlling people's thoughts. Americans were very worried about what they called communist thought control. So one of the responses to that was to produce propaganda, which President Eisenhower explicitly referred to as psychological warfare. He did so publicly on many occasions, so that Americans would become more aware of the ways in which socialist and communist ideas might manipulate them and move them toward the other side in the Cold War.
Well, also, it's interesting that during this time, as the Cold War ratcheted up, you had covert activity, essentially romanticized. You mentioned that Kennedy was a fan of the James Bond novels, but you also had this idea that the lack of governmental transparency was a good thing.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, I think you can see that everywhere now. I mean, you can go to Pottery Barn and buy spy gear for your kids. One of my son's book projects was about a spy named Alexander Brand, who was described in the first couple pages of his book, which is, he's an eight-year-old, as having overthrown several governments without public knowledge. So there's a way in which the idea of covert action has become so normalized by the media that we watch. It's just, it's accepted as a basic fact in our democracy. One of the most popular media experiences of all time is the Activision series of games called Call of Duty, which have logged more user hours than any film, far, far more than any film in the history of filmmaking. And these are sort of simulated fantasies in which a couch potato gets to pretend that he or she is fighting a covert war on behalf of a grateful nation in some distant, horrible place in secret. These experiences are part now of our media culture. They're constantly rehearsed for us in shows like The Unit, Strike Back, Homeland, The Grid, Threat Matrix, The Agency, Alias, The Green Zone, Body of Lies. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so, yes, there is now a romance of the spy, and also of the idea that the public is supposed to keep its pretty little head out of that realm and not worry about it and go shopping or go to Disney World, as President Bush advised us to do after 9/11, and leave the rough and tumble work of security to people who are trained to go out and do it.
Disney World, which of course has Fantasyland.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And Disney World is a theme park that rehearses a particularly upbeat view of U.S. history, one that doesn't include any of the more salacious episodes that are sometimes easy to forget when they become classified. And even after they're declassified, it's my suspicion that many Americans don't know much about U.S. relations with Iran prior to 1979, don't know much about U.S. relations with Central America. And I think in a way that's because the structure of covert government assists in helping us deny or forget what our government is doing on our behalf. We're told over and over again that the good citizen is one who doesn't ask too many questions. The original don't ask, don't tell policy was really the contract that was forged at the beginning of the Cold War when the U.S. built this huge infrastructure of covert institutions that continue to grow. You know, the character Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men really tells us what the state wants to tell us, which is you can't handle the truth. So don't ask too many questions. Just let us do our work.
Timothy Melly is a professor of English and director of the Humanities Center at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He's also the author of the book, The Covert Sphere, Secrecy, Fiction, and the National Security State. Timothy, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back after this. It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.